You know what's great? No, I mean, that's a question. I'm asking if you know what's great. In the ancient world, status was everything. Greeks valued value. They loved recognition. They lived for power. Aristotle described the great man as someone who was extremely proud, who disdained the praise of common people, who delighted only in the accolades of other great men. He said, "A great man indulges in conspicuous consumption. He likes to own beautiful and useless things because that shows others his wealth." Can you imagine buying something just to impress someone? But that's how the Greek culture rolled. For them, the Olympics was not just an athletic competition, it was a religious ceremony. To compete and triumph over others was what made life worth living. And anything or anyone that got in the way of you coming out on top was an obstacle you needed to overcome. It was a barrier to true greatness, even if it was your family. Back then, when kids were born, girls were considered a drain on a family's wealth and often abandoned. Sons who were not born strong and healthy were tossed, literally tossed, onto a pile. Can you imagine viewing your children as impediments to you living a great life? But that's how they saw it. The Romans called it cursus honor. They called it something. Cursus honorum, the race for honor. For the Romans, like the Greeks, it was all about getting to the top of the heap. On the top rung of the ladder for the Romans stood Caesar. For instance, one of them, Caesar Augustus, he had a book written about him entitled The Achievements of the Divine Augustus, inscribed on bronze tablets disseminated widely throughout his empire. Let me read you a couple excerpts. From the Achievements of the Divine Augustus, 3 times I triumphed at oration. 21 times I was named emperor because of victories won by me. Senate voted thanks for me to the immortal gods. I have been consul 13 times. I was the highest ranking senator for 40 years. I held the office of Pontius Maximus. 55 times in my triumphs, kings, or children of kings, were paraded before my chariot. All the citizens, with one accord, unceasingly prayed in every holy place for my well-being. He continues, the Senate voted yet more triumphs for me, which I declined. A golden shield was given to me by the Senate and the people of Rome on account of my courage, clemency, justice, and piety. After this time, I excelled all in influence. Best seat in the house, best spot at the table, top dog. Apparently, it was good to be king in Rome. Now, right below the Caesar were the 600 senators, and below the senators were equestrians, who were people who were wealthy enough to own a horse. Status based on your mode of transportation. Can you imagine? Determining your worth based on what you drive. That's crazy, right? Who would do that? Reminds me of the story of the old lady in the big car who was circling the parking lot one day looking for a parking spot. Finally, she saw a car pulling out and turned on her signal, waiting to pull in. But when the car backed out, before the old lady could pull her car in, a little sports car darted from the other side into the vacated parking place. And a young dude hopped out of the car and headed towards the mall. And as he passed the old lady's car, she said, "I was waiting for the spot you just pulled into." And the guy said, "Sorry, Grandma, that's what you can do when you're young and you're quick." And he just kept walking. But all of a sudden, he heard a terrible crashing sound behind him. He turned back to see the lady smashing her big car into the back of his car again and again and again. And he screamed at her, "What are you doing, lady? What are you doing?" And she smiled. She said, "That's what you can do when you're old and you're rich." In Rome, if you rode on a horse, you were somebody. Below you, both literally and figuratively, was 98% of the population, the regular folk, the rabble. One ancient writer said that these people served an important role in the Roman society. He said, "The existence of inferiors is an advantage to superiors, since then they'll be able to point out those over whom they're superior." They were called the Mediocribus. My Latin's not really good, sorry about it. They were called the mediocres, people who would never attain to any level of greatness. They were just mediocre. And yet, even these people developed varying levels of status that they could seek. They use clothing to show how high up the ladder that they had climbed. If you weren't a slave, you could wear a freeman's cap. If you were a male citizen, 14 years or older, you could wear a toga virilis, proving your manhood, proving you were a Roman man. And even though this toga was hard to put on and drafty in the winter and sticky in the summer, and it kept one of your hands hidden and unusable all the time, they wore them proudly. Can you imagine wearing something that makes you miserable just because it's fashionable? That's crazy, right? He says as he adjusts his tie. Equestrians got to wear fancy togas and expensive rings. Senators got to wear a purple sash around their togas. Status was shown in the clothing that you wore, and it has always been so. Mark Twain once said, "Clothes make the man." Naked people have had little to no influence on society. But greatness was also determined at seating in public events. To get good seats at the musical did not go to the highest bidder, but to the most influential person attending. Care at a medical facility did not go to the most injured, but to the most famous. Best seats at the tables at restaurants, not to the earliest reservations, but to the most important people dining that night. Bob Uecker would never get to say, "Oh, I must be in the front row." Occupations back then were good or bad, depending on how prestigious they were. Can you imagine being able to brag about your career path? Huh. Laws were different for those with status and for common people. Can you imagine? Basically, back then was like junior high all your life. If you were in the in crowd, in, sweet. If you were considered all that by those who can determine what all that was, life was good. But if you weren't, you sat at the loser's table, you did the nasty jobs, you spent your life bemoaning your fate and wishing that you'd been born different. Can you imagine a world so obsessed with status, with being recognized as the highest goal? Can you imagine? It really shouldn't take much effort. If you want a pretty realistic picture of how life was back then, fly somewhere. No, I don't mean go somewhere to see somewhere. Just go, fly, try to get on a plane. The way airlines treat customers today is like life was back in the ancient times. You got first class and you got coach, and it's not the same experience. Coming back from a missions trip once, our flights got messed up, so they decided to fly us back first class. I'd never done that before. Holy cow. That's nice. We got to go on board first. We walked through a separate gate on red carpet that the normal people were not allowed to walk on. Do not set foot on that red carpet over there, no. We sat in front in comfortable recliners. Who knew they had recliners on airplanes? Others had to walk past us as we gloated in our seats. We had our own bathrooms. We got to choose between one of two entrees, neither entree of which I could pronounce. We ate on real plates with real silverware, and we were offered real drinks and made to feel really special, while the people behind us sat behind that curtain, sat packed too closely together, listening to babies cry as they watched Horrible Bosses 2 and ate a Stroop waffle. Try imagining a world where everything's based on status. It shouldn't be too hard. Where people brag about themselves is considering honorable. Like the guy who said, "I'm not one for tooting my own horn, but if I was, I'd be really, really good at it." The ancient world, status was everything. To be great meant to get what you want, when you want it, just the way you like it. But then a baby was born in Bethlehem, and he grew up and he changed everything. And one of the most noticeably different things about Jesus is who he noticed. Yes, Jesus spent time with wealthy and powerful and famous people. A prominent religious professor came late one evening. Do you remember Jesus being the first part ever of Nick at Night? The rich young ruler A foreign military leader came to see him and asked for a favor. Wealthy businessmen, clergy. Jesus had acquaintances in high places for sure, but he never wrote a biography called The Deeds of the Divine Carpenter. In fact, quite the opposite. One of the really unusual things about Jesus is how important he considered people considered unimportant, how he treated everyone with respect. He spent lots of time with common folk, eating with them, talking with them, helping them. He spent time with sick people, with young people, with hourly workers, with women of the night. One Bible scholar said Jesus today would be comfortable hanging out in a bus station. He changed things. Paul Harvey told about some guys once who broke into a store at night, but they didn't steal anything. All they did was go around, and in the store, what they did was they switched the price tags on everything. Can you imagine? The next day, the store opens up, and the shoppers come in to find in electronics, TVs were going for $4.99, computers for $9.99, in jewelry, diamond rings were going 10 for a dollar, which was great. But then the shoppers went over, and they found out that potato chips were $19.99 a bag. And they didn't like that at all. They said, wow, it's kind of steep. Then they went to buy some Budweiser, and it was $989 for a six-pack. So they only bought one. When Jesus was here, he taught people that all the price tags had been changed overnight. Price tags were wrong. Do you remember when Jesus said, he called them together in Mark chapter 10, and he said, you know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentile lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them? Jesus said, not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. And back then, that, to anybody listening back then, would have sounded insane. And to the people who had the status, them's fighting words. They've worked hard to get where they are. You can't just switch things around now. So they tried to dismiss Jesus' teaching as crazy talk. Except he didn't just say it, he lived it. Not only did Jesus say greatness is about serving others, he served with greatness. Do you remember the last night of Jesus' life when they were all in the upper room and nobody's feet were washed? Because there had not been a slave by the door to do that lowly task. But John 13 says, Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So Jesus got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. So here's the deal. Something needed done, but nobody would do it because it was beneath them, literally. They could not lower themselves to do it, literally. That would be so embarrassing. So Jesus donned a slave's uniform and served the guys in the room himself. And in doing so, Jesus forever changed the meaning of dressing for success. See, up to the time that Jesus shows up in the room, great had always meant, you serve me. Great means, I am more important than you are. You do what I tell you to do. I am great. Then Jesus arrives, and he spends his whole life doing what's good for other people, not for himself. He wasn't proud. He didn't draw attention to himself. He didn't demand his rights. In fact, Jesus never forced anyone to do anything. And the ancient world was left with this conundrum. Either Jesus was not really a great man, or they were going to have to change their definition of greatness. And 2,000 years later, we still have people on both sides of that question. Some people today think wealth and status and recognition and acclaim and fame and awards and degrees and accomplishments and titles and possessions and clout and renown make you great. Those are the people who say, when in Rome, or anywhere, actually, do as the Romans did. Keep score like the Romans keep score. Make sure people know who they're dealing with. Be great. Do you know the term gymtimidation? Gymtimidation? It's where you're on a machine at a gym, and some more muscular person comes over and stands there watching you until you get off because you're gymtimidated. gymtimidation. Some people think greatness comes from getting their way. But there's another group of people in the world now, people who willingly sacrifice themselves for others, people who do things nobody else will do, who volunteer for tasks that nobody else wants, people who treat other people like they're important, who willingly put other people ahead of themselves. This group has been influenced by Jesus in the matter of what constitutes greatness. Greatness, these people think, comes from serving others. I heard of an influential American couple who was visiting India once, and they saw a church building on the road that they were traveling down, and they were told that people from the untouchable class would go to that church building to be fed and clothed and cared for, all in the name of Jesus. And that was intriguing to this American couple, so they asked if they could stop and tour the place. As they entered the building, the wealthy American couple saw a young missionary girl bandaging the wounds of an old man. And in the hearing of the girl and the old man, the wealthy guy said, "That's disgusting." He said, "I would not do what she's doing for $1 million. And the Christian girl looked up from the floor where she was sitting, and she said, "Neither would I." Why do we do the things we do? Lots of things are not measured the same since Jesus entered the picture. Seems like Jesus has switched a bunch of price tags around back to what he says was the original deal. And the greatest change might be what's considered greatest. In Jesus' way of evaluating life, you don't have to be perfect to have value. You don't have to be powerful to inspire others. In Jesus' way of thinking, anybody can be great if you're willing to use your life serving others. Jesus has put greatness within the reach of anyone willing to serve. Ways that you can serve: you can sit with someone who's sitting alone at a potluck meal. You could talk with someone on the phone when you know they're lonely. You could shovel someone's driveway when they're snowed in. You could take someone to a doctor's appointment when they need a ride. You could watch someone's dog when they're out of town, although I do not recommend it. Some things might not be easy to do. I once served my daughter by pinning her to a table in a doctor's office as the doctor stuck a huge needle in her cut in half ear. Crease was little, and she did not understand why I was holding her down and letting somebody else do that to her. She did not know the word betrayal at that time, but her eyes clearly showed me that she thought I was betraying her. "Why would you let him hurt me like that, Dad?" is what she was saying. But she needed the anesthesia in the needle in order to fix what was broken, so I served her. To serve, you could go into law enforcement, you could work in a medical field, you could teach, you could be really good at making parts, you could be good at boxing goods, you could lead a large company, you could serve as a politician. One young mother told me this week that she feels like our country's in trouble and she really wants to do something about that, something kingdom-oriented. She really wants to help in some big way, but with changing diapers and fixing meals and working on school projects and refereeing territorial disputes in bedrooms, she barely has time to keep up with all of her motherly assignments. I assured her her service was valuable to our country. You can be considerate of someone else's schedule when you're asking them for help. That would be a way to serve. My mom needed a ride here this morning, and I said I would pick her up around 9:15 so she could be here to be part of the Prelude Trio at 9:30. She said, "How about picking me up at 8:30? I said, "Why would I pick you up at 8:30? She said, "Well, then you could be back in time to be part of the prayer group." Serving a person who's offering to serve you is like service squared, even better. I have one more example. I'm just trying to show you, serving is great. Greatness is when you serve. Do you remember the story of Rick Hoyt, a boy who was born with the umbilical cord wrapped around his neck at birth, which meant he didn't get enough oxygen at that time, which meant he was born never being able to walk or to speak? His parents were told that Rick would be a burden beyond their ability to care for, and they should probably think about institutionalizing their son. But the parents talked about that, and they decided to bring him home and raise him as normally as they possibly could. When he was 11 years old, they went to Tufts University and they asked if they could make a machine allowing Rick to express himself in some way. And the doctor said, well, why? He's incapable of comprehension. And Rick's father said, no, 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 tell him a joke. And when they did, Rick laughed. So they realized and they made him a machine which allowed him to tap out messages by hitting the button with the side of his head, the only part of his body that he could control. And one day, Rick heard about a 5-mile fundraiser for a paralyzed lacrosse player in town, and he tapped out, I want to run. And his father, Dick Hoyt, described himself at the time as a 40-year-old porker who had never run more than a mile in his life, but he said, okay. And he pushed Rick's wheelchair over the race course. And when they got home, Rick typed out a sentence that changed Dick's life. Rick wrote out, when I ran, I didn't feel disabled. So they began to run and bike and swim. Dick eventually pushed his son's wheelchair 26.2 miles of a marathon. In fact, he did that 72 times. And their best time ever was a little over 2.5 hours, which at the time they did it was within 30 minutes of the world record. A world record which, may I point out, was not set by a guy pushing his son in a wheelchair. But this father pushed and pulled and carried his son through more than 250 triathlons. And I have a clip that I would like you to watch, a clip of Dick and Rick Hoyt. And after you watch this clip, you tell me what true greatness looks like.
Exactly what? The doctor said, forget Rick. Put him away, put him in an institution. He's gonna be nothing but a vegetable for the rest of his life. We cried a little bit. We talked, and then we said, no, we're not gonna put Rick away. We're gonna bring Rick home and bring him up like any other child. We knew Rick was smart. We could tell by looking in his eyes. And when we talked to him, he was paying attention to what we were saying. So we wanted to get a computer built so Rick could communicate with us. Everybody came to our house that night for Rick to say his first words. And everybody was betting, what is the first words Rick is ever going to say? His mom saying, it's going to be, hi, mom. And me, the dad, saying, oh, it's going to be, hi, dad. The Boston Bruins were going for the Stanley Cup, and the very first words Rick ever said was, go Bruins.
Dick is a military man, so he knows a thing or two about commitment. This time, he's just months removed from a heart attack. This gift that he gives to his son, or is it the other way around? Either way, it all started when Rick heard about a charity run for a paralyzed athlete. He asked Dad, and Dad said yes.
We went off with all the other runners, and everybody thought that Rick and I would just go to the corner and turn around and come back. Well, we didn't. We finished the whole 5 miles, coming in next to last, but not last. And when we got home that night, Rick wrote on his computer, Dad, when I'm running, it feels like my disability disappears. So that was a very powerful message to me, that we finally found a sport that Rick could get involved in just like everybody else. Is my motivator. He inspires me. To me, he's the one out there competing, and I'm just loaning him my arms and my legs so that he can compete. There's just something that gets into me when I'm out there competing with Rick that I can't explain it, and we're able to go faster. And it's just an unbelievable feeling. Rick and I love the Ironman Triathlon. to be out there competing with the best triathletes in the world, to be accepted to compete along with these triathletes. Just to be out there on that pier with all the other triathletes and then waiting in the water for that cannon to go off, it was just so exciting. The feeling coming down the finish line at Leahy Drive, it's just an awesome experience. With the crowd there, all the excitement, the noise, and the announcers announcing all that, your adrenaline just gets flowing.
I may be disabled, but I live a very fulfilling life. And if someone takes the time to get to know me, they will realize that I am no different than anyone else.
Here he is, he graduated from public high school. He's graduated from college. He's out there competing in road races and triathlons. He lives a happier life probably than 95% of the population. Rick would tell you that, if he was physically able to do something, that he'd probably play basketball or football or hockey. But then he always says, no, the first thing he'd do is sit down and have me sit down in his wheelchair and he'd push me. You know, it really makes me feel good that he appreciates, you know, what I'm trying to do to help him out, and he'd do the same thing for me. Our message is, yes, you can. You can do anything you want to do as long as you make up your mind. You can do it.
If you have ever searched for the meaning of life, stop. The answer lies right here. By the way, Ricky would want us to tell you, the Bruins look pretty good this year.
So the ancient world loved physical excellence and perfection and the joy of competing. They gave us the Olympics, in which mere men try to be like the gods. They gave us the marathon, the ultimate test of human will and strength. What they did not give us was the story of a marathon being run by a man carrying his crippled son the whole way. That's more like a story from heaven. That's more like Jesus. And he is great. So Jesus changed the definition of great. Now we know great is actually found in serving. Like he did. Like he does. Great is like him. Be great. Let's pray.